This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Newsflash. Extreme heat is bubbling up everywhere in the Northern Hemisphere and even in the South. Here are tweets for a single week, the last week of June 2023, from weather historian Maximiliano Herrera and other sources. Texas and the U.S. South, at least a dozen dead as heat dome bakes southern U.S. for weeks. Northern Canada, exceptional heat breeding unstoppable fires continues in the Canadian North. Portugal and Spain, record heat wave in the Algarve in Portugal smashing all records and 20 heat records broken in Spain. Austria, Herrera says, absolutely mind-blowing heat record in Austria. Just before midnight, Oberndorf rose to 36.1 degrees C, beating its monthly heat record. It is one of the highest temperatures ever recorded in Europe at midnight, and one of the very few cases a record is broken in the nighttime. Morocco, WX weatherman Scott Duncan reports, extreme heat in northwest Africa. Morocco has just observed its hottest day on record. 48.5 degrees C breaks the previous national June record by 1.6 degrees C, set in 2012. Saudi Arabia, according to The Guardian, more than 2,000 people suffered heat stress during the Hajj pilgrimage, Saudi officials said on Thursday, after temperatures soared to 48 degrees C or 118 degrees Fahrenheit. Iran. Eastern Iran is also living the harshest heat wave in its history, with weeks of relentless record heat, breaking all records. Northern India, punishing relentless heat continues. China, more records in China, stifling hot and humid night at Shanghai. Several hundreds of records have been falling in China since the first day of the month, and more are coming. Australia, and it's their winter. Queensland and more hit new records high like 32 degrees C, 89 degrees Fahrenheit. Again, in winter. Japan. Extraordinary heat wave in Japan. Records fall by the dozens every day. Caribbean. Never-ending heat record in the Dominican Republic. Under heat waves for months. South America. Summer and winter in South America. There you go. A trip around the world in record-setting heat. It doesn't make the news, and nothing is being done about it. Let's get to our important guests. You always hear about climate change or maybe extinctions by the end of this century or beyond. But what if that horror comes much sooner, during your own life? What is really possible if things go from bad to worse? A shocking new peer-reviewed paper was just published in Nature Communications. The title is Earlier Collapse of Anthropocene Ecosystems, Driven by Multiple Faster and Noisier Drivers. We have reached the lead author. Simon Wilcock is Principal Research Scientist at Rothamsted Research, the oldest agricultural research institute in the world. He is also Professor of Sustainability at Bangor University in Wales. From the UK, Simon Wilcock, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks very much. And just so you know, it's published in Nature Sustainability. That's a different journal.
Ah, Nature Sustainability. Thank you very much for that. Simon, this paper coming out just now, well, it ruined my vacation. I was going to take some time off, but this is too important. It is exactly what many of our listeners feared. You really think the climate could be more threatening much sooner than we have been led to believe?
So what we looked at was how effectively the climate and other pressures might then affect ecosystems. So there's quite a lot of work on tipping points and regime shifts to do with the climate and the atmospheric system, but we focused more on terrestrial systems and so stuff that people are degrading. And we basically looked at whether multiple pressures, so for example, adding climate change on top of the pressure of deforestation, on top of the pressure of hunting, and then throwing in a few extreme events, all of which happen in the real world and becoming more intense and more frequent, how that would affect ecosystem collapse, and it brought them worryingly closer to the present day.
Well, maybe we should take a look at one of the case studies in your paper, and you've kind of alluded to it already. Could you talk about the factors that could bring rapid decline in the great Amazon rainforest?
So the Amazon, is quite well known for being under pretty horrendous pressure. So it's being deforested at quite high rates. The parts that aren't being deforested, many of those parts are being degraded. So, you know, not completely cut down, but damaged in some way. Then it's experiencing quite a lot of extreme temperatures or droughts. And whenever there's a drought now in the Amazon rainforest turns from a carbon sink, so it turns from absorbing carbon to emitting carbon. And other pressures include hunting, mining, and then there's the extreme events. So, like, we're currently in an El Nino year. So we're expecting, you know, quite severe weather in the Amazon this year. These all add up to put the Amazon under a lot of pressure. And there was a paper last year that came out that showed that the resilience of the Amazon forest is declining. And basically that's a warning sign. Like, if the Amazon is becoming less resilient, and then it's less able to cope with these stresses. And then combine that with our paper that shows when there are multiple stresses, the collapses happen sooner, that's when things start to get really worrying.
You also studied the second largest lake in India, although it's called the Chilika, I believe that's how it's pronounced, the Chilika Lagoon. In the West, few people have heard about it. It sounds like an odd choice for a study. Why there?
Primarily because one of my co-authors, Greg Cooper, he did his PhD focused on that lake. So many of the models that we use to look at tipping points and ecosystem collapse, many of those models are actually quite simple, whereas the model that Greg built in his PhD that looked at that lake, it was really very complicated. It had lots of interactions between the fisher people around that lake and also the ecosystem in that lake and the sea washing into the lagoon. It's a very, very complex model. So by focusing on that model, we could effectively check that the simpler models that we also included in the paper were giving us similar answers. And if we got similar answers from the more simple models and the more complex models, then that implies that potentially we're onto something and we start to then believe the result.
In March 2021, I interviewed a young climate scientist, Johannes Lohmann, he was a postdoc at Denmark's Niels Bohr Institute at the time. And Johannes studied past glacial abrupt climate changes. He warned Earth could hit tipping points much sooner than expected, partly due to the rate of climate change. What are some of the problems with the speed that climate change is developing?
Essentially, when things happen, so we looked at two things in our system. We looked at rate and noise and cumulative stress. So what we found in our paper is there's a couple of ways to trigger a collapse. One of which is just sheer pressure, cumulative stress, the equivalent of the straw that broke the camel's back. The other of which is rate. So effectively swamping the system just by the change is just too quick for the system to keep up, for it to buffer itself. And that is, well, the opposite of having a frog in boiling water, right? A frog in boiling water slowly gets used to it. And just like you, when you step into a bath, if you stayed in the bath and slowly heated it up, you'd probably be all right. But if it's slightly hot and you just sort of jump in, you feel that it's really, really hot and you have to jump out straight away. And that's essentially because the change in temperature was too quick for you. And ecosystems are just the same.
But in fact, your team and like-minded colleagues have abandoned the term tipping point. Why, and what should we be talking about?
We avoided the phrase, in the paper because it's to prove a tipping point, it gets quite mathematical. You have to prove what's called this hysteresis loop. That effectively means that in one direction, it takes a different amount of energy, effort, to move the system in one direction to another. A good example of something with a hysteresis loop is the rubber band, right? Very simple rubber band. To move it in one direction, you've got to stretch it out. That takes quite a lot of effort, depending on how big the rubber band is. But then when you let it go, it takes absolutely no effort to watch it snap back. Like, it does that by itself. And in this paper, we didn't run the models in both directions. So we didn't, like, prove that hysteresis. But we picked models that effectively had hysteresis shown in them previously. So these models are showing tipping points, but all the catastrophic collapses that we picked up were not necessarily part of tipping point cycles. Essentially, they were just very extreme. extreme collapses. So we focused on the language around threshold-dependent changes. So we crossed this threshold, and then there was an extreme collapse in the ecosystem. But essentially, the two often go hand in hand.
But, Simon, could Earth have as yet unknown systems acting like built-in brakes, a reaction that might slow down the rate of warming and eco-decline warned about in this new science?
Yes, there could be, like, balancing feedback loops that we don't know about and that potentially weren't in the models. So that's always possible. And, you know, it's not all bad news. Like, tipping points don't all have to be bad. You could argue that the spread of mobile phones across the world, that's quite a positive tipping point. And, like I said, that does have some kind of a hysteresis loop. Like, everyone goes out and buys a smartphone. And then it's very, very difficult to then take all those smartphones away from people because they've got used to them in their daily lives. Tipping points don't have to be bad. And if we seek to understand them, that maybe we can start to pull the right levers and push the right buttons to use tipping points to recover ecosystems. So potentially, you know, we can have unexpectedly quick recovery if we understand how to trigger positive tipping points rather than the ones that make the news now are effectively the negative tipping points. And they're the ones we have more information on because of the stress that we're putting our ecosystems under.
When trying to figure out how quickly ecological catastrophe could arrive, a second essential concept is sort of convergence and the interaction of a wide range of drivers. And in the paper, you break these up into primary drivers, secondary drivers, and noise. Let's start with primary versus secondary drivers. What is the difference, and can you give us some examples?
Yeah, so essentially, that's almost an artifact of the way the models were built and designed. So earlier I said most studies looking into tipping points, a lot of them use quite simple models. And so that's because it's easier for us to understand what's going on in a system if we simplify it. So the simplest system you can sort of simplify it down to is there's one stress and it's causing damage to a system, an ecosystem. It's making the ecosystem lose resilience and then we see what happens and that may be a tipping point. And so a lot of the models were built in that way. So they're like thinking, I want to understand the stress of, for example, increased population on the fish population in a lake in India, for example. But whilst that's useful for helping us understand that particular stress, it doesn't reflect the real world in the same way because that just doesn't happen. That stress in that isolated way just doesn't tend to happen in the real world. There's always another stress as well, or occasionally something else happens. And so that's where these secondary and tertiary stresses come into it. So effectively, there were other variables in the model that we could alter, but maybe the model wasn't designed when it was originally built with those variables being altered in mind, but they could be altered in a way to replicate a stress on a slightly different part of the system, so the actions of a different stress. And so by doing that, we were able to basically better simulate the stresses that are happening in the real world, which are complex and, you know, there's many at a time. And hopefully that then makes the output from the model a bit more representative of what is happening in the real world, even if the results are a little bit worrying.
The third type of driver this paper calls noise. What do you mean?
So, again, to simplify things down when you want to picture the simplest system, you don't have any noise in there. So you just put in a real simple ramping up of a stress. Your stress, say, would go from 1 to 10, and you would just slowly, you know, go 1, 2, 3, 4, sequentially all the way to 10. But again, that's not what happens. So if we look at, for example, temperature change across the globe, you know, sometimes it goes up quite a lot, and then it goes down a little bit. So there's there's that little bit of noise in that overall increasing temperature system. And so what we did was essentially we inserted that back in to our stress to, again, make it more realistic. And this is the equivalent of extreme events. So, for example, if I go back to the temperature example, occasionally you get a heat wave. So don't you? And that would be noise pushing up the temperature unexpectedly up a little bit. And then it might go down on the next time step, so in the next month or something like that. And so that's why we added noise into the model, to sort of capture the impacts of that.
Well, after 3 years of La Nina in the Pacific, we're now confident that we're entering an El Nino in coming months. Those are natural oscillations in the ocean states. They can modify the climate. Does that qualify as noise?
Yeah, yeah. Because essentially, they cause extreme events. It does tend to make, for example, the Amazon will be drier and hotter this year than it would have been in the La Nina years. First, essentially, that will provide an extreme value in the overall trend of increasing temperature. So that's exactly the kind of effect that we were trying to capture by putting noise into our signals.
Well, you found that every case you modeled has the capacity to speed up, but they did not all act the same or react equally to the same forces?
No, yes. So we found that some systems were brought close to the present day by addition of another driver. So we had a primary driver, and if you added a secondary driver, that had a large effect, whereas other models showed that noise had a bigger effect. And all models, though, did show that the combination of multiple drivers and noise was generally the worst-case scenario, which is worrying because that's probably the most similar scenario to the present day.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with research scientist Simon Wilcock. New science warns of nasty surprises, and perhaps ecosystem collapse could come sooner. And just the fact that we're not expecting extremes and breakdowns, we're not planning for them, isn't that another huge problem, Simon?
Yeah, that is a big problem. They're really hard to plan for, though, because effectively what we're talking about is low likelihood but high impact events. And there's a lot of uncertainty involved. So whilst we may be quite... We may think that a tipping point might happen in the Amazon, for example. It doesn't mean it will happen. If it just happens gradually or if it doesn't happen, then the differences are so extreme that it's really, really hard to plan for. One thing we can do, though, is essentially detect these things in advance better if we improve our monitoring. So if we monitor several stresses rather than just the easy-to-measure ones, if we just monitor the easy-to-measure ones, that's the equivalent of just looking at the primary driver, which we know would be a bad idea, because if the paper shows that if you only focus on the primary driver, then effectively these ecosystem collapses will happen unexpectedly, and that's because the stress of the secondary and tertiary drivers that you weren't looking at creeped up, and they caused the system to collapse. But by better monitoring, say, all three drivers in a system with three drivers, you'll see it coming better. You'll see this tipping point coming. You'll be able to react and be like, hang on, we're putting the ecosystem under too much stress here. We've picked up these warning signs, like the loss of resilience in the Amazon forest that I mentioned earlier. We've picked up on these warning signs, and then we've done something about it. So I think it's that kind of adaptive management that we need, and it has to be driven by better monitoring.
Well, here's a quick quote from the new paper in the journal Nature Sustainability. Overall, global warming will increase the frequency of unprecedented extreme events, raise the probability of compound events, and ultimately could combine to make multiple system failures more likely. So what is the role of what you call erratic events in accelerating the impacts of climate change?
So essentially that's the noise we were talking about earlier. What seems to happen is that although the noise we had in our model could move the system towards a tipping point, it can make a stress worse, but it could also move the system away from that critical threshold. It could make the stress, you know, less bad. But because there's such a basically a cliff edge at that threshold that causes the tipping point, on average, the effect of the noise, these extreme events, is bad, because if you reduce the temperature by 1 degree, that makes the system a little bit safer. But if you increase by 1 degree, that effectively plummets you off a cliff. So the average change was always quite extreme by adding noise.
Reading this free open access paper, I learned almost as much about what we don't know as what we do. What strikes you as key unknowns?
Yeah, there is quite a lot of unknowns here. So tipping points and these kind of abrupt changes, they're often most studied in what I would call a fluid system. So we have quite a lot of scientific studies looking at threshold-dependent changes in the atmosphere. So, for example, you know, temperature, carbon, and also in lakes. There's quite a lot of evidence from lakes going from clear to like an algae-filled state. But terrestrial ecosystems might behave a little differently. They might not be quite as connected because they're not as fluid. So actually, the collapses might not spread throughout the ecosystem in the same way. And also, I think we've only just really begun to grapple with how we can use the same kind of systems dynamics, the same kind of theories, in a positive way. So I think it's really in its infancy where we're beginning to understand, you know, how can we pull the levers to cause a positive tipping point and an unexpected recovery. And when we have that, when we've started to understand that, we can really start to harness what is essentially a bad news story in a really good positive way.
Well, one of the qualities I love about good science is when authors are not afraid to raise limitations like that or even objections to their own work. What other cautions and disclaimers did your team add in?
Well, I think one of the main ones is these are models, right? Models don't always reflect reality. And so we need a lot more empirical data of real systems. But the bad news is, to get that empirical data of systems collapsing under stress of multiple drivers, effectively we need to collapse systems. And we can either wait for that to happen naturally, like in Lake Erhai, which is we mentioned in our paper, and that was one of the data sets that gives us encouragement that our models are showing the same thing, the right thing. Or we can do that experimentally. So currently I'm working on a project where we're building basically plots to put them under future climate extremes so that we can then watch to see what happens. So if they do critically fail, we can see whether that was under, say, just a temperature increase that we put them under, or did they go through that failure sooner if we put them under a temperature increase and flooded them, for example. So those kind of experiments is what we need, and that's what a lot of my collaborators and I are now moving on to, both in like glass houses, in greenhouses, but also in the field as well.
On June 22nd, along with co-authors John Deering and Gregory Cooper, you published an explainer for the public. And among other things, you caution ecological disaster cannot be fixed by governments like the bailouts of Western banks in 2008. Why not?
Well, essentially, because we don't have the same stock in the back of our pocket. You know, if you want to bail out a bank, effectively, you print a bit more money, don't you? If we want to bail out of an ecosystem, we can't suddenly print more species. That's not how it works. So essentially, nature has to bail itself out, and that doesn't obey our rules. If we can't, as of yet, push a button and cause an ecosystem to suddenly be like, oh, yeah, okay, I'm going to start recovering. Essentially, some of the research that I talked about earlier, where we can potentially harness the systems dynamics theory to increase rates of recovery. Essentially, that might give us a bit more of that power, but it's not something we can do today.
There was decent media coverage for this paper. The phrase ecological doom loops generated over 35,000 hits on Google within 4 days. It'll probably carry on as a meme, but I'm still pretty sure of two things. Most of the public won't know about this, and UK residents will keep flying to Spain in winter, even if the Spanish climate becomes like the Sahara. Where is the space for this new risk awareness to really take root?
I think in adaptive management. I think essentially what this experience shows is that if we monitor things, and if we monitor as many stresses as we can monitor, even if some of those stresses are quite hard to monitor, so potentially quite expensive, it is worth it. Because it's a better way of then forecasting whether the system we're interested in is basically going towards the point where it's going to be in trouble. And then we're going to avoid it. We can take action to start to change people's behavior, you know, maybe convince them to take the train to Spain instead. But we can only do that once we've given a red light. We've basically said, look, this is a danger sign. We really need to change behavior now. And enhanced monitoring of multiple stresses will really help us give that warning.
I was kind of surprised to find that you work with an agricultural research institute. You're a professor in sustainability. Is it a leap from that to the collision of climate change and the whole living world, as in this big paper?
I don't think so at all. So I sort of think of myself as a systems scientist. So I study multiple systems, and I often focus most on socio-ecological systems. So systems that have a bit of nature going on, but also some impacts of people. And that describes agriculture perfectly. You know, essentially agriculture is us harnessing nature to grow food. And there's obviously a large human influence because you've got a lot of actions on behalf of the farmer and all the other farm workers. And essentially, many other ecosystems are also just socio-ecological systems. So, for example, if we consider a national park, we might have lots of ecology, lots of nature going on in that natural park. But you've also got pressure from people maybe going to visit the national park. And that kind of socio-ecological system, maybe the social part of it is smaller than the ecological part, but it's still a socio-ecological system, so it's still sort of within my area of expertise.
In conclusion, how much sooner did you find that big system breakdowns could happen?
We found that essentially there was a bit of a range, but if we have additional stresses and or noise, so more extreme events, we found that the collapses occurred about between roughly 38 to 81% closer to today than they would have if we just had one stress on the system, which is quite substantial.
Are you worried about it?
Yes, I am. I'm worried when you combine effectively the results of this paper with a couple of other papers, and we sort of hinted about the Amazon quite a lot in this conversation. So essentially, what the paper that we've recently published shows is that there is a real risk with multiple drivers and extreme events of the Amazon any system, but the Amazon moving from a rainforest-like state to a savanna-like state. And if you couple that with, you know, a finding from last year that the Amazon is losing resilience, then maybe that starts to suggest that when we're talking about moving it towards the present day, maybe we're actually talking, oh, it's quite close to the present day. And then you couple it with a paper that we published in 2020 in Nature Communications that showed that once the Amazon does cross the threshold, it would only take, I think it was about 49 years to actually collapse. So if the collapse is happening soon, let's say 2030, or starting then, potentially it would then be over. It would be a savanna by 2080. And to be honest, that frightens me to be in the last generation, amongst the last people that see the Amazon rainforest as a rainforest and not as a massive savanna, is really, really worrying, because obviously when it switches to a savanna, that could start a huge domino effect, because that will release a lot of carbon, that will increase global temperatures. If that increases global temperatures enough, then you have ice sheets melting, for example, which then maybe increases sea level rise, and that then would impact a whole world, basically, ecosystems, people, cities, and that's basically a domino effect that I would rather not start.
We have been speaking with Principal Scientist Simon Wilcock from Rothamsted Research and Bangor University in Wales. You can and should read this worrying new paper called Earlier Collapse of Anthropocene Ecosystems, Driven by Multiple Faster and Noisier Drivers, as published in Nature Sustainability. Find links to that and more about this paper in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Simon, thank you so much for giving your valuable time with us.
Thank you very much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Texas is roasting in triple-digit heat week after week. Canada is still on fire. Heat blisters break out all over the world, including India and China, going beyond human endurance. Oceans have never been so hot, at least in the northern hemisphere. Where are we, and what is happening? Paul Beckwith is the Canadian scientist who tracks extreme climate change. He taught climate science at Canadian universities. Paul reported for Radio EcoShock from the COP26 climate conference in Glasgow. He makes science simple for the rest of us on his popular YouTube channel. From Ottawa, Canada, Paul Beckwith, a warm welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, Alex. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, and it's been a while for us.
It has been a while. It's just been so hectic trying to keep up with the climate science and with events predicted for years that are happening now. How has the air been in Ottawa lately?
We had our first taste of the very, very unhealthy air from the wildfire smoke back on June 6th was the first day. So it was a big deal for Ottawa because Ottawa has very little industry and the air quality is always exceptional here, or usually exceptional. So June 6th was bad, and then but June 7th broke all records. I think at that point Ottawa was the most polluted city in the world. On the air quality index, the U.S. air quality index, we reached 511. And that's the PM2.5 particles, particulate matter 2.5 micron diameter and smaller, are very unhealthy because they're so small they can get deep inside the body and even into the bloodstream eventually, cause all kinds of inflammation and harm. Those levels were over 500 micrograms per cubic meter. Now, to give you an idea, they say that 22 micrograms per cubic meter is equivalent to smoking one cigarette. So that was a well over a pack in that day for anybody that was outside, you know, men, women, or children, elderly, youth. Everybody was basically smoking over a pack of cigarettes that day. And same with Montreal. There's a very good chance that Montreal will get hit with this. And then, you know, a day or two out, it's going to be on the East Coast again. I think Boston is in the crosshairs right now. I mean, New York might miss the worst of it. So there's nothing that's gone down with the wildfires. There's more fires. They're sending more smoke. They're burning more area. It's just that the wind directions haven't been blowing the smoke into Canadian cities in the last little while. It stayed mostly up north, and it's gone across the Atlantic Ocean into Europe. So I know Ireland and Scotland and Spain, you know, it was going into countries like that. And exceptionally bad. I mean, it's the air currents can sometimes refocus the particles. And I know when on June 7th, New York was hit. Well, Ottawa was hit June 7th. New York was hit a day or two later. And New York was a lot worse than Ottawa was in terms of, it looked like, or Mars. The sky was just orange and very, very difficult to breathe.
Yeah, this is really a global event. The EU's Copernicus satellite monitoring system just sent me a notice that Canadian wildfire smoke has officially reached Europe. People are underestimating what this means. Now, wildfires are made more likely by climate change. That makes sense. But can they also be a driver for more warming in themselves?
Absolutely, because they wipe out a strong sink of carbon. I mean, the boreal forest, which circumvents the planet in the northern hemisphere, is a vital sink for carbon dioxide. You know, as we burn more and more of the wild areas of the boreal forest, not only do you release the carbon you know, while the fires are going on, but there's no absorption of the carbon anymore from the atmosphere. So you really, the ability of the forest to absorb carbon is greatly reduced. So CO2 levels will definitely go up in the atmosphere. You also get the smoke from the fires and actually travel right up into the Arctic and fall and darken the snow and ice up there, which leads to a very strong melting feedback because the darker surface absorbs a lot more sunlight. So this is a huge problem too. And what people don't talk about, I mean, forest fire is a bit of a misnomer because in the boreal forest, about 80% of the fuel that is burning is actually, it's the peatlands on the ground. It's the litter on the surface floor that's fallen branches and trees and needles, etc. And it's also the permafrost underneath that is starting to, you know, warm up and ignite. So 80% of that smoke is basically from the ground floor of the forest. I mean, the trees are also burning, you know, up to the crowns, but most of the smoke is from, you know, the moss and all the stuff that's on the surface of the forest.
Ooh, when you talk about peat fires, you kind of send a chill down my spine. In 1997-98, there were huge peat fires in Indonesia. It buried Asia as far as Singapore with smoke, but it also led to one of the warmest periods on record. Of course, it was also aided by El Nino, but peat fires, very, very serious. We had them in the Russian heat wave of 2010, too. The peat bogs all around Moscow and beyond were burning, and it was highly smoky and highly intensive carbon-releasing event.
Yes, there's a tremendous amount of carbon, you know, organic carbon within the peat and, you know, in the ground. And when that starts burning, you know, you have a huge problem. But also, you know, these fires have started so early this year in Canada because sometimes, you know, when the fires start July and August, as long as they're not threatening infrastructure, they're just left to burn because usually by the fall, you know, as temperature gets colder and there's more precipitation, the fires go out naturally. But, you know, they're starting in May and June, and, you know, if they don't put them out, they're going to burn all summer. So we're breaking all the records with the Canadian fires, and it's also happening in Siberia. You know, we've had record temperatures in Siberia and massive fires there, but we don't hear so much about those. But they are, you know, from satellite monitoring and other means, we can see they're producing tremendous amounts of smoke as well and burning up lots of the, they call it the taiga in Russia as opposed to boreal forest, but it's basically the same thing.
Let's move on to the extreme heat. Now, like the state of Florida, the government of Texas doesn't want to talk about climate change at all. They don't want to teach climate science in the schools. But it's amazing how that can happen, even as heat like nobody has ever seen just settles in for a long stay and punishes people there day after day. What do you know about this weird Texas heat dome?
Yes, so I have to get back to the jet streams because, so just a quick recap, I mean, they circumvent the Earth, and they exist because of the temperature difference, you know, the Arctic cold, the equator's warm. So that temperature difference sets up a pressure gradient, which then gets the winds going, and they get concentrated or focused into these narrow pathways, which we call the jet streams. And, of course, as the Arctic is warming at much higher temperatures, you know, eight times the global average, and that temperature gradient to the equator is lowered, so the jet streams have to slow down. They slow down, they become wavier, and when you have very high peaks in the north-south direction of the jet stream, they tend to get stuck. Meteorologists call it kind of a blocking condition. And under a high-pressure area, there's very little rainfall, you know, very high temperatures, very few clouds. So it all contributes to making it hotter and hotter. So we have one of this heat dome over Texas is exactly that. The jet stream is kind of locked in this configuration where it stays hot there for, you know, extended periods of time, hot and very dry. I mean, I think we're reaching temperatures over 50 degrees Celsius there, and it's been ongoing, you know, over most of the last month.
Yep, 120 in the shade, as they would say in the United States. Paul, are we in the hottest time since humans, as we know ourselves, began?
Certainly, we're right up there. And I think this El Nino, which is just getting started, will push to break all records by a large significant margin. We've had the cooling phase of the EMSO, the El Niño Southern Oscillation variability, and there's been a tremendous amount of heat that has been stored within the oceans as a result. And that heat is shallowing, and we're setting record temperatures by far in the North Atlantic, for example. Off the UK, I believe it's 5 degrees Celsius warmer than normal, the oceans. And in the southern hemisphere around Antarctica, we're getting extremely warm sea surface temperatures, and we're getting warming of the water down below, which is increasing the melt rates, and the whole ocean circulation pattern seem to be shifting. So we're facing huge consequences from all these years where we've had more and more heat being trapped in the Earth system.
Lately, you have been widening your view. Tell us about your recent video called Vicious Accelerating Feedbacks Between Far-Right Politics and Climate Catastrophe.
Unfortunately, some of the things that occur as a result of accelerating climate change is, you know, there's areas of the planet which become less suitable to supporting human life. And as a result, we're seeing record amounts of people being displaced from their homelands, from their cities, or even from their countries. So there's migration, tremendous amounts of migration. These people have to go somewhere. And climate migrants, if you like, go to countries that have, you know, a bit of uncertainty in the political systems. Then basically, if parties are on the left leaning, they tend to let in, you know, they tend to be more humanitarian in terms of we'll take these people, you know, as many people as we can, et cetera. And then the right-wing elements within the country and the political system say, hey, you know, wait a minute, we don't want all of these people taking jobs and taking resources, et cetera. We can't afford them. You know, they burden our system. So then there's a backlash against the immigrants. And a lot of these backlashes can lead to, you know, right-wing governments getting in. And then when the right-wing governments are in, then they basically get rid of the climate policies, what little there is. You know, then climate continues to worsen around the world when enough of this happens in countries. So there's all of these feedbacks. You know, we often talk about feedbacks, whether they be, you know, positive feedbacks, which are not positive. There's nothing good about them. They're accelerating the changes that happen. So you can think accelerating feedbacks, making things worse when you hear positive feedbacks. And then negative feedbacks, which, you know, cause a sort of slowing down of the changes. I mean, in the climate system, physically, we seem to be having mostly positive feedbacks, making things worse. But now we can talk about the feedbacks to humans and our actions and what we do. And a lot of these are positive feedbacks, which are accelerating the climate change problem. So you get in this sort of vicious loop, you know, where climate worsens and worsens, and there's more and more migration, and then there's more and more climate change as a result, because a lot of the policies are just thrown away by the governments that come in. So there's all of these sort of things going on, and I think people in governments kind of get overwhelmed by all of the things that are happening so quickly. And as a result, poor decisions are made. They're all short-term decisions, you know, in the moment sort of things, knee-jerk reactions. And these things are not conducive to making any headways against climate change or any other issues for that matter, really.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Canadian climate system scientist Paul Beckwith, returning with the big picture on the climate shift. You and I have talked at least a half dozen times about Arctic sea ice, one of your specialties. What is the latest?
Yes, there's always a lot happening in the Arctic, and, you know, often the sea ice is talked about, which we'll do that again, but let's not forget the snow cover in the Arctic in the spring, because basically the Arctic is getting a lot darker because of losing the sea ice. We're also losing the snow cover in the spring, and a darker Arctic absorbs more energy, and that increases the temperature amplification in the Arctic compared to the rest of the planet, which then, you know, has that huge effect I've already discussed on slowing the jet streams. So a paper came out just recently that actually tried to really kind of get a handle on, you know, when we can expect the Arctic sea ice to essentially vanish. One summer, you know, one mid-September in the not-too-distant future, we're going to have what I call the Blue Ocean event, where there's very little sea ice left at the end of the summer melt season. Usually it's defined as less than a million square kilometers. So the date of that happening, in the IPCC, the last version, the Assessment Report 6, they came to the conclusion from papers that, yes, in intermediate and high-emission scenarios, we would completely lose the Arctic sea ice, but not before 2050, 2060 even. And in the low emission scenarios, we'd never lose it. So this new paper, it looked at the CMIP-6 modeling, all of these different models to model sea ice, and it found that they weren't really even, if you run them backwards, they weren't matching up to the observations. You know, what they did in this paper was a very simple concept. They took the CMIP-6 models, the most sophisticated computer models on sea ice. They ran them backwards. They found that they were way much higher than the observations. So they then forced the models by scaling factors to match the observations in the past. And then they ran them forward using those same scaling factors. And they found that the sea ice would vanish under all emission scenarios, including the low emission scenario. And under the intermediate and high emission scenarios, it could vanish as early as the late 2030s. So they basically moved the vanishing date likelihood up by over a decade, from 2015 to late 2030s. So basically that's it. It was a very simple idea. But, I mean, combining the sophisticated models with the observations, so they're all self-consistent, they got a more realistic picture. I think it's still a bit conservative. You know, I think it will happen sooner. Some people are saying, you know, we could have this Blue Ocean event during this phase of the El Nino. If we have a super El Nino, it looks like we might be heading that way. And also, you know, if you look at the heat going into the Arctic from the atmosphere, also from the oceans, the ocean sea surface temperatures and the currents underneath the ocean, you can see that these things are all, you know, attacking and reducing sea ice. And what's also happening at the same time is the same thing is happening to Antarctica. I mean, for decades there, Antarctica sea ice was pretty stable. It actually was increasing, I think, about 1.5% per decade or something, but it's dropped off a cliff in the last decade or so, and it's setting record lows. And we're not talking about just a record low. We're talking about many, many standard deviations below anything that's in the records. So this is happening in Antarctica as well, which is very concerning.
Another underestimated stress point is simply having enough food for over 8 billion people. So I watched your video called Wheat Yields in the USA and China Threatened by Heat Waves Breaking Enzymes. What is that about?
Yes, well, over the years, people have been working trying to make crops more heat resistant. It's interesting because, you know, we had the so-called Green Revolution where we were able to double and then double again and double again for many different doubling periods, the yields, the amount of food that we could get in terms of, you know, whether it be maize like the corns or wheats or grains. We greatly improved yields per hectare. We didn't increase farmland that much, but we increased the amount of food that we could grow, and we improved farming techniques and so on, you know, drip irrigation, more places being irrigated, the fertilizers, which are fossil fuel derived, of course. But we're reaching a limit. I mean, like any other plant, you can reach a limit, and the temperature can actually be so warm that the crop itself just can no longer tolerate it. It just can't grow. It's just too hot. It desiccates, and the protein molecules, you know, when you cook an egg, what you're basically doing is you're getting denaturation of the protein bonds in the egg. I mean, enzymes are biological catalysts. They're very important for chemical reactions in the living plant or living animal. So there's lots of enzymes that work, and these enzymes just break down. They lose their properties. They're no longer able to function as enzymes when the temperature gets too high. The yields plummet when that sort of thing happens. So we're reaching temperatures, you know, in many wheat-producing areas where that can happen. So yields aren't just going to drop slowly. It's a threshold, another one of these threshold things, nonlinear processes where you're okay to a certain point and then suddenly the yield will collapse.
Now, Germany is building 10 new ports to import liquefied natural gas. Vietnam is counting on LNG. Country after country says they are going with gas. They say gas is greener, but it is all just methane, really, the same methane you have been warning about for over a decade. Paul, how do you feel about a world powered by methane?
Methane was touted as, a bridge fuel. And, you know, the term natural gas, right? I mean, some marketing genius said, hey, let's call the methane natural gas, and we can heat our homes with natural gas. I mean, natural gas sounds great. It's natural. Unfortunately, you know, it's a very potent greenhouse gas. You know, has an enormous global warming potential compared to CO2. And since 2010, we're getting a lot more of it being produced from the wetlands around the planet, you know, as the wetlands are heating and drying or rainfall patterns change. So people are counting on natural gas, and in order to transport it, it's very difficult to transport a gas in volume. You know, this is, oil is perfect, right? As a liquid, it's easily transportable. Basically, natural gas is a gas, of course, and they cool it down until it's liquefied. So they have to keep it at very, very low temperatures and transport it that way. So it's very expensive and very bulky to do. But, you know, some countries are, as you say, are going that way. I mean, we're burning more and more fossil fuels than ever on this planet. I mean, the world goes through about 100 million barrels per day. And we also go through about 60 million barrel equivalents per day of so-called natural gas / methane. It's all increasing. And anytime you use methane and you have a leak rate, if you have a leak rate of the methane into the atmosphere from your pipelines of 1 or 2%, then you could argue, well, methane, when you burn it, it's cleaner burning, it produces less CO2. But if there's, I mean, we're not experiencing leak rates that low. We're experiencing leak rates 5 to 10% on most pipelines and systems, and therefore methane is worse than or just as bad as burning coal in terms of the effect on climate with very, very high leak rates. So it's no solution at all. It's just extending the problem.
I totally agree. Now, moving on to AI, papers already credit machine learning or deep learning. Do you think artificial intelligence will help humans understand climate and the real-life systems we live in?
That's sort of a hope. I mean, of course, AI, there's loads of opposing views on AI. It's going to destroy humanity all the way to it's going to save humanity. It's going to solve, you know, some of the issues like climate change that we haven't even been able to make any sort of dent in, because basically our entire society is predicated on burning fossil fuels. I think if scientists start to incorporate AI into their, you know, their thinking on, you know, if you're looking at climate solutions, if you're looking how to make, say, cement that doesn't emit CO2, or if you're looking at phytoplankton in the ocean to capture carbon, or growing things like kelp, you know, having kelp farms or things like that, I think AI could be used as a tool to do a lot of simulations that might save you from making mistakes, and, you know, might help identify which technologies can have the most promise and things like that. So it's very double-edged, like any other technology, but I mean, we haven't talked about the James Hansen paper, Global Warming in the Pipeline, yet. He's working on another one, Global Sea Level Rise in the Pipeline. He's also working on his book, Sophie's Planet, which I'm hoping is sort of like an updated version of Storms of Our Grandchildren. But we basically were really running out of time very fast to try to stabilize our climate system. Well, Hansen's, ever since he testified in Congress in, what, 1988 or something, he's been trying to raise alarm bells about climate, and we haven't, you know, I mean, just look at greenhouse gas levels over time and plot the dates of all the climate conferences on that graph, and it, we're nowhere near addressing this issue, this problem.
So how can we find out more about Hansen's work?
I did a video summary of it. It's a very technical paper. There's a lot in there. I'll revisit it soon. I'm gonna try to create some video shorts, and I'm going to make a debut on. Here's a commitment. I'm going to make a debut on TikTok. I'm going to try to do some videos on TikTok with just some of the key points of Hansen's findings. Right. I'm just trying to figure out ways to get the message out more because it's very important. But in a nutshell, if you look from 2010 back to the late 70s, 80s, you know, over that time period, our planet was warming about 0.18 degrees Celsius per decade. Now, look at what happens after 2010. Basically, the warming rate has upticked significantly, it looks like, but it's still too early to know for sure. But Hansen's been arguing that the warming rate has notched upwards, and it's notched upwards between 50 and 100%. So he draws two curves, and we're somewhere probably in between them, according to Hansen's latest paper, Global Warming in the Pipeline. So I said it was 0.18 degrees Celsius per decade rise since up to 2010. Since 2010, it's 0.27 degrees Celsius per decade, up to 0.36 degrees Celsius per decade. So that's either a 50% increase or a 100% increase. And there's lots of reasons for this. One of the big reasons is that the Earth energy imbalance has greatly increased. If there was no imbalance, the Earth would be stable temperature overall, the whole system. But, you know, as long as the Earth energy imbalance is positive, then you're going to get warming, and the higher it is, the more warming you're going to get. And one of the big factors, it looks like, is that we've had a reduction of aerosols over the ocean specifically since 2015, and an even bigger reduction in 2020 of these. It's basically marine fuels have sulfur in them, and the requirements on the amount of sulfur have been tightened significantly in 2015 by the International Maritime Organization, and also in 2020 they were tightened again. Now, over the oceans, there's very few aerosols because the sources are mostly man-generated. Some over the ocean, like from plankton, the dimethyl sulfide, a few other things, but most of the aerosol, it's pretty clean environment in the air over the oceans. So any ships crisscrossing the ocean would put up these aerosols from their smokestacks, and they would, it's not just ones you could see, but they would spread far and wide, and they would cause a huge cooling of those regions of the ocean. So we're not getting that to the same extent now, and this could be another reason why we're seeing extremely high ocean temperatures, and they happen to coincide for the most part with areas of very, very high shipping. So I think there's a direct relationship going on here, but this needs to be confirmed by peer-reviewed science, which, you know, it's too early for that to have been done. But I think that might be one reason why the ocean temperatures are going crazy right now.
Well, we're out of time, and we're out of time in this interview, unfortunately. From Ottawa, we've been talking with the climate system scientist and science communicator Paul Beckwith. You can find links to the videos we talked about and all Paul's work in my show blog at ecoshock.org, and you can learn the facts of climate change by searching for Paul H. Beckwith on YouTube. It's like a free university for everybody, and the science comes out in real time as it's published. Paul, thank you for your work and working for us all, really.
Well, thank you so much, Alex, and, you know, I have to give you a big shout-out and thank you to your work over the years with Radio EcoShock. It's, you know, we're all trying to do our bit, right? Because we understand, you know, what's going on with the climate systems.
Yes, we love life and we know that big trouble is coming, so we should try and change. I'm Alex Smith.
Check out all our past programs free at ecoshock.org.
I've got to change this thing. She's way too crazy, way too hot. Normal is what she's not.